Trump's refugee ban and violent Christians. That and more coming up in the Good News Show. Diane, were you on the train this morning at all, travelling somewhere?
No, not this morning. But there was an incident over in East London, in Dalston, Kingsland, to be specific. Dozens of terrified passengers were forced onto the tracks at Dalston, Kingsland, after commuters drilled, overheated and billowed smoke. One passenger spoke of sheer terror and panic on board the train, and this was during the rush hour. Police and emergency services were scrambled to the scene at 7:15 this morning.
Yes.
And to report several walking wounded. Now, first, you know, they said it was exploding batteries. That was the first.
Yeah, it sounds like a terror attack, doesn't it? That's what it reads like if you look at it. Yeah. But nothing of the sort. Yeah, it's... so you've got a report there about a battery, have you, exploding battery. I see that they appear to think it was a drill overheating, a commuter's drill. I don't think we have any more details on that, but what the question that springs to my mind is, why? why was a commuter carrying a drill? And why did
it
overheat?
Yeah.
These two questions spring to mind. Woman in this report, the woman who thought the drill was a gun, was left with bleeding fingers and a pain in her back. So there's a lot of detail missing here, but it does. The problem with this, it would have been pretty terrifying if you saw smoke and you're on a train. And I think from the reports we have, most of the injuries seem to be people trying to run away. This is where the terrorists have actually caused terror, not with this incident, but in other incidents, because everyone just assumed that it was a terror attack. The problem with this incident is also that it is quite funny. I'm sorry for the people involved. I know that I would also have been terrified, but it's just so weird. That's the strange thing about it. So.
It's quite surreal, and this woman said, only when I got up, I realised my fingers are bleeding, but now I can feel the pain in my back. Well, it says people are falling and stumbling.
Yes.
How does a drill, which I presume wasn't being used, how does it overheat? It's a weird story. And of course, memories of 2005 being on a train and it being stopped, and it being told that, we were told that we couldn't go any further due to a power surge.
Right.
And of course, we later found out it was an attack. So no wonder people were scared some 12 years later.
Yes.
But then to see, it's just a drill.
Well, it's like being told if you think there's a fire in the building. No, it's just a drill. Different meaning of the word drill. I know that, but in this case, an actual drill.
Yeah, but it is good that there wasn't anything serious and that nobody was, hurt majorly.
So that's the report from Dalston, Kingsland, British railway station. There was a panic attack, but not a terror attack. But this is something we need to keep a watch on, because in this way, the terrorists win, in that they're causing terror even when they're not actually responsible,
even when they're doing anything. Yeah.
Now, what's this report then that you have on Democrats having strange views about Christianity? Now, I know I've been to quite a few Bible studies where, daggers are drawn over a particular translation of the word righteousness and what is it in the original Greek. But I haven't actually found them that violent, I have to say. That's not true, folks. No daggers. It's a dagger-free zone in a Bible study.
Well, it says 7 in 10 10 Democrats admit to using a drill on a train. No, it doesn't say that.
Okay.
A new poll has revealed that 7 in 10 Democrats believe that Christianity is just as violent a religion as Islam. Guest poll feels that the majority of them view Islam as peaceful, while the majority of Republicans do not. According to, I guess that's Breitbart News.
Breitbart, I think, yeah.
The trusting attitude towards Islam is revealed in the February 2017 poll, which follows 17 tumultuous years of attacks against Americans motivated or shaped by Islamic ideology throughout the state, from 9/11 to the Orlando nightclub last year. Before I read any further, I think, you know, actually, no, I will read a bit further, then I'll comment.
Yeah, sure.
1 in 7 believe Islam is more violent than other religions, but in contrast, Republicans have a far cold view in Islam. 63% of them view Islam as aggressive compared to other religions, and only 2% views Islam as more pacific than other faiths. Yeah. And there's a couple of quotes here. One from the Quran: "I will cast terror into the hearts of those who have disbelieved, so strike them over the necks and smite them all over their fingers and toes." Mm. And then there's another one: "So when you meet those who disbelieve in battle, strike their necks until, when you have inflicted slaughter upon them, then secure their bonds and either confer favor afterwards or ransom them until the war lays down their burdens." Mm. I have nothing to defend Islam about, you know, I've said that, I think, a bit before. However, in the defense of the Quran that cannot speak, it is easy to cherry pick a few verses from the Quran or the Bible. I mean, when people go on about a vengeful God, they cherry pick bits of the Old Testament. So it's easy to do that with the Bible as well. However, Christianity is not a violent faith. It speaks against violence.
Yes.
And any violence in the Old Testament was either somebody attacking in an unrighteous way, or it was God bringing justice against unjust people.
Yes,
he did use armies to do that. There were battles, there was violence. But, you know, Jesus never commands violence. You know, he is the pacifist of time.
I mean, Jesus saying, pray for those who persecute you and turn the other cheek, and these are the well-known sayings. We know them, and they've become, I suppose, the bedrock of what we believe about not starting violence. That comes from our Christian belief. What I'm saying is the reason that people now criticize Christianity actually comes from Christianity, in that, you know, that's the basis of our culture. Whereas in Islamic cultures, there isn't the same. When they quoted those two verses from the Quran, I note the those when so when you meet those who disbelieve in battle, it's not necessarily talking about on the battlefield, you know, in the battle. No. So when they're waging jihad, so coming to another country, they expect people to believe. But in their defense, they do have very specific rules. So they shouldn't kill women and attack women. And you notice when there was that barbaric attack on a soldier who was just walking down the street in London. Rigby, I believe his name was, the man who was attacked. Yeah. The man who attacked him, we don't care what his name is, because obviously he's a violent idiot and should be ignored. But the person who died, his name was Rigby, who was, you know, a good soldier. Not only that, he was going about, what he was actually doing that day was raising funds for, you know, soldiers who were injured and that sort of thing, and so needed help. Now, he was walking along, he got attacked and almost got his head cut off. Now, Then several women came up to help, and the man didn't attack them, this attacker. You know, he was following the Muslim rules. So they do have certain rules of combat. And you could say, well, we're not at war with them, but that's not the point. They think they're at war with us. So, you know, that's a sort of in their defence. However, even saying that, you can't say that it's not violent.
No. And there are violent people who call themselves Christians.
Yes.
But if they are violent, are they all Christians? Because, again, Jesus doesn't advocate violence at all. Now, he does speak of armies, and he does speak of battles and kings, but, you know, in terms of your sort of normal people, human beings, no, there is no call on these violence. So, so Christianity is of peace, yeah, and heavenly peace, and, you know, we are called to spread the word and spread that peace on earth. We've done it through force over the centuries, which isn't good.
No.
We as a collective forced Christianity on people over the centuries, which isn't good, and it shouldn't happen again. But we are called to give the gift of, or well, give people the opportunity to come to their own faith.
Yes.
Whereas Islam, yeah, it does say things like that in the Quran.
Yeah. So why is it then? Why is it then that so many Democrats believe that Christianity is as violent? Why do Democrats have this bias? A response from a Republican, well, Democrats are stupid, you might say, but no, there must be something more. There must be something more to it. That can't be the case. I mean, it's probably half the country are either Democrat or independent and sympathetic towards Democrats. So I mean, why do Democrats think that?
I think it's because of the way the sort of stereotypical Republican is, kind of stereotypically big, loud, full of bluster, probably Southern. President, or I'm going to tell you what, that kind of stuff. And a lot of them sort of imagine sort of right-wing Baptists, you know. That doesn't mean they're violent, but maybe that's the image they might portray.
Yes.
And, of course, the Democrats are, they're against it. Yes. Yes. I don't know.
No, but it is interesting. It is interesting. Now, we don't want to delve too much into this because it's perhaps a subject for a whole show, but the reaction of the left, for which we're talking about mainly Democrats, to the Donald Trump presidency has been one of violence. Has been not just protests, but violent riots against him. Whereas if you think back to the right-wing Republican response to Barack Obama, the Tea Party, who were campaigning to have real conservative Republicans in office, they would have big demonstrations and they'd be fully armed because, they're the side. Republicans tend to be more likely to have guns. And yet there were no scenes of violence, that certainly none reported, and I'm pretty sure they would have been reported if there was anything significant. Just didn't happen. Where it seems to happen all the time. So it's strange that they should have that view where it seems to be the other way round. Perhaps it's a case of projecting your own fears and angst onto other people. I can't explain it. So if any listeners say, why is it that Democrats think Christianity is as violent as Islam? And don't say it's because they're all stupid, because that might be true, but you've got to support it with evidence if you're going to say that.
So, I mean, to sum up, there are violent Christians or people that call themselves Christians who are violent, but the text and the faith and the man himself was against it. So we should all be.
Yes, now let's...
And if you're not, I'll hit you.
Trump's refugee ban. Now, there's been several comments about this, talking about the ban on refugees entering the country which has been put in place specifically for Syrian refugees. The rest of the ban of immigration into the country is temporary, 90 days, I think. But one megachurch pastor has given voice to this common thought or common opinion that I've heard from several sources, saying that the Trump's refugee ban, as he calls it, is at odds with the gospel. Now, this particular megachurch pastor has 30% of his congregation being immigrants. Now, you could say, well, that means that he's biased, but not necessarily, because these could all be legal immigrants, and they could all be from other countries. Might not be from those seven that have had the temporary restriction on coming into the country. But it could well be that highlights it in his mind. Certainly, the churches that I've been in before, the one that you and I, James, were both in Edgware, was 50% of non-British, they were British, but non-British heritage were the makeup, maybe mainly Ghanaian and Nigerian. I can understand that as the pastor of the church, he would have a particular interest. His name is Dan Scott. He's of Christ Church, Nashville. And he says that the travel ban for refugees is at odds with the gospel. And we've got a report here from the Christian Post. And he said in a phone interview that a spirit-filled evangelical Christian community in Tennessee has been helping refugees from different nations settle into the United States for many years now. And he explained that his church has been assisting many people from Nepal, as well as a number of nations in Africa and Asia and Latin America, to learn the language and get to know the US financial system. So they're providing help. He goes on to say, we help them with clothing, help them to make friends, open the church for them, and they become members and part of the spiritual family. Now, his response then is coloured by that. That's his experience of trying to care for people coming into the country. Trump issued an executive order on January the 27th that temporarily suspended the US refugee settlement program for 120 days, indefinitely suspending it for Syrian refugees, which I mentioned earlier, and barred visitors from seven Muslim-majority nations for 90 days. That's what I was mentioning earlier as well. Now, so most of it is temporary, although for Syrian refugees it's permanent. And there is, of course, controversy about it because the US District Judge James Robart halted this ban on this restriction, subject to, of course, now an appeal from the Trump administration. So Scott's criticizing this, the pastor's criticizing this, he's saying it had like a proper explanation, people hadn't had time to prepare for it. He said, I think it was mean-spirited. I think it represents a rising tide of nationalism that is at odds with the gospel. Now, that's it's interesting. No, I have great sympathy, I say, with his point of view of, you know, this going against his ministry, that he's trying to care for people coming into the country. But I don't really understand the second part of it. It's mean-spirited because people weren't prepared. But how is it a rising tide of nationalism to have quite a limited ban on certain people from countries that are the main sponsors and the main sources of terrorism around the world? That, to me, that doesn't make any... That does not make any sense. What do you make of this?
No. I think, my first thought is if they are genuine refugees and they are, you know, in dire straits and they've lost everything, or there really is a high chance of them being killed, if they can get to a safe nation and that nation can help, then fine, great. But I think within reason, you know, I think there should be a limit to how long they're here. I think they should be tracked while they're here. I think integration, learning the language, I think that that should be compulsory. And then I think, obviously, people like MI6 or the CIA will be monitoring their home countries, and then when it's safe to do so, then maybe they should go back, unless they're going to contribute fully and properly to the country they're in. Now, that also spoils over into this whole free movement of people thing, which is different, but in a similar way, you know, these sort of 16-year-old refugees who turn out to be 35-year-olds who cause violence in a Western country, that, how do you vet people fully? In some ways, I understand, you know, you've got to be as secure as possible, your home nation. Similarly, if we were all at war in the West and we had to flee to Syria, I would expect Syria to have full checks. So it has to work both ways. It's going against the gospel. Well, you know, how long did Jesus spend in Egypt? We don't know exactly, but he fled. You know, he was, technically you could call him a refugee.
I think you could. It, almost exactly. He's got the definition in that he was fleeing persecution and stayed until the threat had been removed. But interestingly, here's an interesting thing that I've noticed about that. Egyptian territory at the time abutted up against Israel. You know, Egyptian-controlled territory was the next place that you went to. So when he fled, he had to go about 40 miles, that sort of distance. And he went to the first country available. Now, if you come from Syria, the United States of America is not the next country.
No.
I'm just going to point that out. For fans of geography, it's quite a distance away. And so I to a large extent, and with Donald Trump on this one, in that I think that the measures he's made have been taken by, I think, if you go back, pretty much every president going back, they've had to do this at some point. It's not an unusual thing. The countries that he chose were actually chosen by the Obama regime. These are the countries that are risky countries. They're ones that we should do this to. They just didn't actually follow through. So they weren't selected by the Trump campaign. I would add others if I were them. The ones that Saudi Arabia, for example, they seem to sponsor terrorism a lot. You know, why are they not included? Afghanistan, you know, lots of drugs seem to come through from there, if not terrorists. So I would, you know, I would widen it slightly. I don't understand I understand that the outrage, but I think it's political rather than real. I think it's party political rather than real. And I think that this pastor has been fooled by the rhetoric of Democrats and others who are against Trump. On this, you know, Trump does some odd things, says some strange things, and has to backtrack and weave his way around. Like originally in the primaries, he was saying, oh, I, Donald J. Trump, are going to ban all Muslims temporarily. It was still then going to be temporary, but that isn't what he's done. He hasn't done that. He's done a very, very reduced, a mild thing, really, of just having a geographical definition of who can't come there. And I think that he's been fooled. I think this pastor's been taken in by Trump's opponents. Trump, in this case, okay, just because Trump says and does some silly things doesn't mean everything he does is silly. This is actually quite sensible, and I wish they'd do it in Britain, you know, have some more restrictions on who comes into the country. We've had problems with terrorists coming here. And the thing is, there were claims made, oh, well, most terrorism seems to come from people who are living in the country. As if people who move into the country don't have children. You know, they're done by people who are first generation. Mm-hmm. Means that their mum and dad came into the country. And as you've said, James, in our country, in Britain, we've had problems with people coming, saying that they were children, and so they were treated differently, and actually they weren't children at all, and some of them were quite a bit older. And if you see pictures of them, you think, There's no way that you'd even think that was a child. Come on. Yeah. You could have tried it. You could have had a shave, you know.
That's it.
And so I just don't see this pastor's point of view. I think he's got it wrong. I think he's wrong on this one.
I mean, as I said, I'm all for helping within reason. But I think, you know, I would like to help folks to help themselves.
Yes.
You know, I think we go over there to sort problems out, but do we really? And then what sort of leave people in the worst place? And then there's resentment to the West. Yes. So people do want to go over and be violent.
I think, I agree with you. I think Britain and America and other countries, but maybe us mainly, need to do bear responsibility for this violence, and particularly bombing. And under Obama's regime, so much drone bombing, which isn't that accurate, you know, killing people in these countries, actually, that have had the temporary ban put on them. You know, bombing so many, killing so many people. Of course they want to, you know, retaliate, wouldn't you? You know, stop doing that, But the response is, you have some responsibility. And Trump, I don't know whether he'll be able to follow through, but there were reports that he'd phoned, is it the King of Jordan? I think they have a king, don't they? And also spoken to someone in Saudi Arabia to arrange for safe zones to be set up. And that to me, if you're going to fund that, because yes, you do bear some responsibility, makes more sense, because then the people, when they've finished, as in when the threat has been removed, they can go back. Whereas if they come over to the US, are they really going to return? Yeah, I mean, it just seems unlikely. I think they're there for good then. So it's a lot of effort as well. You've got to learn this new culture and everything. Then you're going to go back to the old culture. But, you know, there's more of an overlap in culture, expectations, etc., in a place like Saudi Arabia and Jordan to Syria than there is between the United States and Syria. So, I'm sorry, Scott, or Pastor Scott, rather. The Good News Show thinks you're wrong on this one. Wrong on the criticism, right on his ministry. I mean, keep helping people once they're in the country, of course, and helping them to integrate, helping them to learn. Brilliant work, but maybe stick to the ministry and leave the political comment to us here, you know.
That's it,
Says, because we always know what we're talking about.
Wycliffe group, and they've been translating Bibles for some time. They're probably about, certainly in Britain, probably about one of the most famous translators. A pioneering rapid translation method is offering people the chance to read the gospel in their mother language for the first time. There you go. Mute that advert. That was actually an advert about Donald Trump.
Oh, that's great.
Right, yes. Anyway, going back a bit, a pioneering rapid Bible translation method is allowing people to the chance to read the gospel in their mother language for the first time. And this has been growing exponentially around the world, changing lives and leading many in thankful praise to God. Wycliffe Associates, which has been translating Bibles, 50 years now, they're planning on opening 1,000 new Bible translation workshops this year using mobilized assistance supporting translation, the MAST method, based on an 8-step strategy. And it reduces what could be years or decades of waiting for translated Bibles. And there's a quote here, it says, after the end of each workshop, we have translators sharing their experience. And over again, Christian translators have said that it's been the most wonderful experience, spending all day, every day for 2 weeks translating the Bible. And that's from Linda Farnstock, the MAST regional coordinator. Mm-hmm. And it said the translators feel that God speaks to them and recounts the story of a translator in Puerto Rico. One of the workshops, it says, who pushed back in the chair, got down on her knees with tears in her eyes, and she began to thank God. and talk about how God has spoken to her and how valuable the scriptures were. Well, of course, they're immeasurably valuable. The team, it's the concept which is new. The teams of translators work in parallel, and instead of waiting for days for one of the 8 steps to be translated, the method accelerates. Well, that's good, I suppose, because people have been waiting years. Each translator is assigned one chapter of one book. They have a few minutes to read that chapter. Then they discuss what's going on in the chapter, who the main characters are, anything they would like to share. And steps 3 or 4 see the translators chunk the text in smaller portions and then draft a translation into each part. In order to ensure accuracy, they first self-edit their draft, then it's also peer-edited. Facilitators then review the translation. That's good. That way, nothing can really slip through the net. And they review the text to make sure that it's used correctly and check no verses were omitted and that the text comes off in a natural and clear manner. The work produced through this methodology is excellent. It compares very favourably with text produced through other methods. And it goes on, but I think this is very good. Rather than the 14th century, as monks would translate a Bible each, and there's instances of the monks getting bored and then doodling, yes, writing other things in the side of the page.
Yes,
this
yes
is very modern, well, you would, very boring. Yes. Famously wrote one monk.
Yes.
But I think this is great because you know, all translations are going to be slightly different, but as long as the absolute essence and the meaning of what is said is unchanged and the method is as accurate as it always has to be. For example, John himself said, you know, don't change my words. Then I think, great, the more people that work on a translation and the more people that can therefore get Bibles and get the word to them, it's wonderful. And yeah, so it's very encouraging work. What are your first thoughts?
Well, I'm fascinated by this method. You break it down, therefore you can, I guess it's almost like crowdsourcing your translation, isn't it? It's it's fascinating that that's sped it up. I know someone who lives in Liverpool, so near to where I am now, who works for Wycliffe Translators. And he travels around the world getting people started off on various translations. It may be that he was part of this, because he talked about starting people off. The same sort of idea. He didn't explain the whole system like you've just done, but it may well be that. He was saying how it takes years and years to get a translation completed. So if you can speed that up, it's brilliant. But the thing about hearing the Bible in your own language is the fascinating thing is that God, whatever your language, God can speak to you. Then it can speak to you by His Spirit. But there's something about having the words there, and we know that that must be true because God, you know, sends people out to tell His message. So there's translation through a person then, so there's always translation involved. And if you can speed up that process, brilliant. Because like, we need to get the real gospel message. That misunderstanding about Christianity from the Democrats over in the US in our earlier period. You know, if they spent time reading the Bible, I think that they would come to a different conclusion, reading the Bible straight through. And remember when I first did that, read it from beginning to end. I know some people split it up so it's in chronological order, the order of things happen in the Bible.
Yeah.
But I just read it straight from beginning to end in a year. I took a whole year to do. It makes a big difference reading the whole thing, and you see then the there's a story to it that's pretty obviously one author or editor, maybe God's the editor, I don't know, behind it. So, and that's in English, of course. So that was a translation into English, and that I found very powerful. So I want other people to have this experience. So people in where is it? Chizubia, Chikuhani, Sifwe, not in those are the languages, Portuguese. Now that's that's great that they can have their own languages. I mean, what I guess when we're looking at spiritual effects, we talk quite a bit about politics because that's sort of part of the remit of the show. But this sort of thing is more powerful, I think, than political change. Getting the word of God to people is the biggest agent of change that you can possibly
Absolutely.
Have.
And in that, you know, it's not a political show per se, but we are Christians in the world. Mm. That's why we comment on it, yeah. You know. But yes, this is the real stuff. So we ended with this. Now, I've gone through quite a few translations over the years. You know, I started way back when with a little, still got it actually, a sort of children's good news with coloured pictures and that.
Oh, yeah.
I got a youth Bible, which I still have. Mm-hmm. Then I got the New Life Good News. Now I really love the ESV. That's my favourite. And that and the NIV are somewhat interchangeable. They're kind of quite similar in their translation, I think, a lot. But for me, the ESV is my Bible of choice. Some people prefer the more weightier language of King James because it's late medieval and it was written for the king. So the language is quite... language has a lot of gravity to it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the King James too, but I like the ESV personally because for me, it just says it. Some people like the Message.
Yes.
That's the kind of modern take on the gospel.
Yeah, well, there were so many, aren't there, English translations that we have a great choice. But yes, I also use the ESV, the English Standard Version, particularly for when I'm studying, because although, you know, I was taught New Testament Greek at college, it's still easier for me to read it in a good translation like that. And they make an effort to be concordant in that a word is translated in the same way each time. So if you're doing a word search in English, it's almost the same as doing it in the original language because you get the same translation usually done each time. Of course, sometimes the context doesn't allow it. So it's really good for studying as well. It's good translation, pretty clear, but also sticking close as possible to the original words, although, of course, the word order has to be changed. So it'd be interesting to know from our listeners, you know, what translation do you read most? You know, for your, when you're just reading it for yourself, what translation do you read? It may not be an English translation, of course. You know, maybe your first language isn't English, and you're listening in English, because that's what we speak. But maybe your Bible isn't in that language. I remember being in quite a few different places where we would pray, maybe praying the Lord's Prayer. This is a common time when it's done, and people would pray it in their own languages, which is interesting experience, because so that they could say it from the heart. But I guess that's all we've got time for this week on the Good News Show. So wherever you are, whatever language you speak, wherever you come from, and I guess wherever you're going to, we want to pray for blessings upon you from all of us at the Good News Show.